Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour, continuing with our series of conversations with remarkable minds. Donald Trump's coup d'etat, the erosion of the Constitution and civil rights, criminal conspiracy, and the White House's conflict with the deep state. My guest, Danny Sheehan. Danny is one of our nation's most important and influential constitutional and public interest lawyers. During the past 45 years, he has handled the public cases that they would not otherwise have been exposed to, including without him, we would have had no Pentagon Papers. We would not have known the truth, the real truth about the Watergate break-in, or what was really behind the Iran-Contra. It was not what the media was telling us, nor the truth behind the Karen Sukwild murder. He has represented victims of the Three Mile Island nuclear disaster, fought against the American Nazi Party on hate crimes. He is also a leading attorney on behalf of the Native Nations at Standing Rock against the North Dakota state government and the private corporations building the pipeline. He is the founder of the Christic Institute and the Romero Institute, the latter being a nonprofit public policy center in Santa Cruz, California. Danny is law review at Harvard University, later returned to study at Harvard's Divinity School. He is the author of The People's Advocate, and his two websites, Daniel P. Sheehan, that's SHEEHAN.com, and the Romero Institute.org. Nice to have you with us again, Danny.
Terrific, Gary. It's good to be here again. It's been a busy time.
It sure has. And I have never seen this much propagandizing by the media in, I believe, in American history. I cannot turn on any television program, indeed most of the radio, without hearing that the only people responsible for Hillary Clinton's loss was the FBI Director James Comey and also Donald Trump doing business with the Russians. They hacked the DNC, and because of that hacking, were able to release information that embarrassed Hillary. At no time has the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, and all the other myriad mainstream publications simply been honest and asked this question. Was it really the DNC hacked by the Russians? Do you have proof of that? If you have proof, bring it forward. There is no proof. To the contrary, we have proof today, and just today, that the person who was involved in getting the actual documents out of the DNC was then assassinated. There were two bullets put in him, and yet, where the Washington, D.C. police say that it was a robbery, there was nothing stolen. His cash, his jewelry, his cell phone, the things that are normally taken when a person does a robbery, were still intact. We also have, through WikiLeaks now, and through the investigation that is ongoing, much of this is going to be revealed tomorrow on my radio program, that more than 22,000 documents were now shown to have been downloaded on this person's server at the DNC and then given to WikiLeaks. This had nothing to do with Russia. Russia did not in any way, shape, or form steal the documents from the DNC. These were from an insider. We know who the person was. And by the way, this is the only time in WikiLeaks history, in Julian Assange's history, of releasing over 10 million documents, not one of those documents ever shown to be inaccurate, where WikiLeaks put up a reward. I believe it was around a $20,000 reward. Why would WikiLeaks put up a reward for information on the capture and conviction of this, whoever killed this person, with all the other homicides in the United States each day? Why this one? Obviously, it was because that was their insider. And yet, we have independent verification from a former ambassador to the United Nations of this as well. That brings me up to the subject of, why are they covering this up? A junior reporter with 3 months' experience would know that the information on the New York Times front page every day is mainly inaccurate, biased, or lacking any sense of objectivity. It is my contention, and that's where we begin, that this is really the deep state. In fact, they're so brazen, I do not believe that they feel that they can be harmed even if they're uncovered. Who's the deep state? Who are the players? Well, they're domestic players and they're international players. It's important to remember that Trump's appointment to many federal agencies have disrupted the deep state agendas in those agencies. Factions with inside the CIA, factions within the Department of Defense, factions within the National Security Agency, factions in Homeland Security, factions in the Federal Reserve, in the Treasury, in the Justice Department, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, a couple of vital federal courts dealing with national security, the Eastern District of Virginia and the Southern District of Manhattan, deep pocket politicians in Washington, the Council on Foreign Relations, Richard Haass, Robert Rubin, Zoe Baird, David Rubenstein, Tim Geithner, Janet Napolitano, and others, I believe, my personal opinion, are members of the deep state, the Trilateral Commission, which is a huge international group with involved in diplomacy, academia, foreign affairs, mainstream press, the Business Roundtable, the CEOs and chairs of J.P. Morgan, Walmart, Northrop Grumman, American Express, Boeing, MasterCard, Lockheed Martin, Dow, IBM, AT&T, the military-industrial complex, once again, Raytheon, General Dynamics, Halliburton, Booz Allen Hamilton, the largest intelligence contractor, perhaps the largest IT internet companies, Google, Microsoft, Facebook, the prison educational complex. We also have private mercenary companies like Aegis Defense, mainstream media corporations, many who are on the Council on Foreign Relations, and big agri company. Most notably, my feelings are Monsanto, Dow, and BASF. Internationally, major Wall Street and European banks and firms, the World Bank, Jim Young Kim, the president, International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagrand, World Trade Organization, Robert Azevedo, head, and International Bank of Settlements. The board is composed of all the main banking cities throughout the world, the G12, the World Economic Forum in Davos. The chair is Klaus Schwab. OPEC and the major oil companies, notably ExxonMobil, British Petroleum and Shell, NATO, the Bilderberg Group, and Saudi Arabia, Israel, AIPAC, Mossad, and the UN General Assembly. Now, that is not to suggest that any one or all of these organizations and institutions and individuals are directly involved, but together in a conspiracy, what I'm suggesting is that what Donald Trump is doing is not aligning with their interest, and therefore for political, for financial, for, let's say, suggest ideological reasons, they do not want to see him in office. They did not want to see him. None of them supported him in the election. They all supported Hillary Clinton. Why? Why would all of them have that in common? So please distinguish the difference between organizations and individuals who have an outstanding reputation, impeccable reputation and credentials in the public arena, but who are absolutely aligned against Donald Trump at this time. Why? Is that an accurate overview or not, in your opinion?
Well, actually, as you know, Gary, my direct experience has been in investigating specific inflictions of damage to look into the specific participants in this larger group that you're talking about that have inflicted damage, whether it's in the Karen Silkwood case when we uncovered the deep connections between the Kerr-McGee Nuclear Corporation and Petroleum Corporation with the Central Intelligence Agency smuggling 98% pure bomb-grade plutonium to Israel and Iran, and also to South Africa and Brazil. Same thing with the Iran-Contra crisis, the actual bombing of a press conference of Eden Pastora, and I investigated the death of the half a dozen journalists that were killed in that particular bombing and tracked it back to John Hull, who was smuggling the weapons from Ilopango to the Contras, working with the Reagan-Bush administration. And then I tracked it up into the Bush administration and tracked it back historically into the Central Intelligence Agency, back into Cuba, back to the end of World War II with the fascists. And you know that kind of from-the-bottom-up type of investigation that I've done for all this time has led me to the conclusion that it's similar to what you're talking about, that there is an interlinking kind of directorate at the highest levels of the financial institutions and the major oil corporations, very specifically, who are attempting to move into the area of nuclear power and build nuclear power plants to maintain a monopoly control over the source of energy in the world. And this tracks all the way back into Germany with the linkage to the pharmaceutical corporations, the major military industry. Now, the difficulty is that if, in fact, one asserts that there's this major conspiracy going on of all of the major financial and corporate institutions in the entire world, people tend to think that, well, it's not really so much a conspiracy you're talking about as the system, as the structure itself. So what I've been attempting to do is to take particular cases. For example, now, as you mentioned, I'm representing Chase Iron Eyes, who was the Democratic Party nominee for the sole seat in Congress in North Dakota back in 2016. He's a Lakota Native American who is a member of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe and the Great Sioux Nation. And he is the sole party that's been charged by the state of North Dakota and the oil corporations, Sunoco and the Phillips Petroleum and the Energy Transfer Partners, two of the partners of which were Donald J. Trump and Rick Perry, for example, that he has been charged with inciting insurrection against the state of North Dakota and challenging the oil pipeline in the Dakota Access Pipeline. I'm going to be defending him in that criminal trial, doing the investigation that shows that there was this effort, the extraordinary way in which that pipeline, the Dakota Access Pipeline and the Keystone XL pipeline, that were coming from approximately 45 degrees north latitude all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico at 25 degrees north latitude to pump the oil down across tribal lands into the warm water ports, is virtually identical to the pipeline that was being planned by the Carlyle Group to come from the Caspian Sea in Russia at 48 degrees north latitude down to the Indian Ocean at 25 degrees north latitude, virtually identical, through the tribal lands of Afghanistan. And that the exact same group, the Carlyle Group, the people who sat on the board of directors of the Carlyle Group were George H.W. Bush, George W. Bush, James Baker, Frank Carlucci, and the person who was their point man in carrying on these negotiations to try to build that pipeline was General Richard V. Secord, who was a major player in the Iran-Contra scandal. So that what we've seen is that there is a constant pattern here of the major financial institutions and the major oil corporations and energy corporations having a stranglehold on the essential resources of the planet. And we've talked about it before, that at the immediate end of the Cold War on December 31st of 1991, when Gorbachev signed the agreement releasing all of the different republics of the Soviet Union to become independent nations if they chose to, that at that exact point, the Bush administration of George H.W. Bush, whose Secretary of Defense was Dick Cheney at that time, they met in the West Wing of the White House, and they promulgated a 1992 United States Defense Department policy planning guidance document, which openly advocated, well, secretly advocated in a classified document, the establishment of full spectrum dominance militarily across the world, and that they explicitly stated that they were going to be working with the United States and Canada and the UK and France and Italy, the new reunified Germany. And they actually went so far as saying, and we can invite Russia to join in this new Northern Industrial Alliance now that they have spun off all of their ethnic provinces. And we link that together with Steve Bannon having this secret Skype conference with these ultra-right-wing elements in the Vatican, the Knights of Malta and Opus Dei, in this thing, this institute called the Institute for Humanity, that they're all a bunch of right-wing crypto-fascists, and he was telling them specifically that they needed to mount a major Third World War to stop the indigenous people of the world rising up against Christianity and capitalism. I mean, that this is a thoroughly thought-out, coordinated operation that's going on at the highest levels, and we're confronting it up in North Dakota right now with the indigenous people, the Lakota people, the people of the Seven Council Fires, standing up directly in the face of these two major pipelines that they're trying to build right straight across their sacred territory below the single source of fresh drinking water that they have. Now, this is the way that I have come to this over the 50 years that I've been out of Harvard Law School, or out of Harvard College, and went up to Harvard Law School and started at the number one corporate litigation law firm in the world, at Cahill Gordon, looking at this stuff from the inside. I was in the interesting position of representing NBC News and the New York Times in the Pentagon Papers case and in the case that established the right of journalists to protect their confidential news sources, you know, that I've had this kind of direct piece-by-piece experience that's gone on over the past 50 years that has really enabled me to get a bird's-eye view of what this operation looks like. And what we have to do is we have to put it up in front of the American public, and through alternative media such as your show, a number of other sort of ancillary media outlets, to get the information to the American public and to the people of the world that we are belling this cat, that we are naming this beast. This is, in fact, as Pope Francis has pointed out in his papal encyclical on global climate change, this is transnational corporate capitalism. It is a specific form, a specific business vehicle in which the people who run the major corporations, who own the stock, who own the company, who manage the business, who call all the shots, are in fact completely immunized against any type of personal legal liability. And that therefore they run these corporations in a way that just devour the natural resources of the planet and spew out all of the waste materials and toxins and effluents of these industries into the environment, to the point where they're actually poisoning the entire environment now.
Danny, I want, so we are in alignment on this.
Yes.
That it's not simply a matter of misunderstanding or miscommunication. It's a matter that they're using Trump for their needs. They have all of their individuals in positions in his cabinet. They already control the intelligence agencies. They control all the major apparatuses of government. They control the world business community, and they control the media. So therefore, had Hillary Clinton been elected, no matter what her limitations, no matter what she would have done, they would have simply been in alignment because they profited from it. You're looking at Washington, D.C., a city you know very well. Yeah. There are over 400,000 private contractors, many of whom are in alignment with the military-industrial complex. So even though they're individual competitors, they're fighting for their dollars, they know that there's enough money in the different operations, the Pentagon, different operations of the, let's say, the national security agencies, that they can all make billions of dollars every single year, but only if they continue the talking points in sync, that we are at risk of ISIS destroying us. We must put all this money and strip away all the other monies that go to feed people to ghettoize America. Now, that said, so it's the same cast of characters. It's getting beyond this kind of simpleton notion that, well, you know, there's really no conspiracy. Yes, there are conspiracies afoot. Mm-hmm. And Danny, we have been witnessing an unending flurry of actions in order to strip away many of our federal protections due to the hard work of Consumer Advocate. My hero is Ralph Nader, also Public Citizen, mm-hmm. and nonprofit organizations committed to sustaining some semblance or democracy and to protect the health and livelihood of citizens, as you're doing now with North Dakota and the native population. Trump's executive orders have been opening numerous back doors for private interests, such as oil companies you just mentioned. The head of the largest Exxon now is our Secretary of State, and military contractors, and to undertake inestimable damage on society and on the lower middle classes, the unwashed masses, you just said, and also on medicine, health, and so much more. Yes. And yet here is someone who just admitted giving secrets to the Russians and defending himself that as president, he pretty much can do whatever he wishes.
That's right. The Nixon defense.
So we're entering enormously dangerous waters where it could take years before any vestige of a civil democracy is restored. And there's a coup d'etat, in my opinion, and if I'm wrong, challenge me on it, please. But I believe we have a creeping coup d'etat underway, and the mainstream media and the pundits are utterly either clueless about it, what is happening under their noses, or haven't got the guts to call this administration for what it is, fascism, and under a royal family kingdom. So before we get any further on the erosion of the constitutional and civil rights, and possible causes for charging Trump and others in his administration with criminal conspiracy, and how Trump is bumping up against the deep state or the shadow government that is now discovering its agenda and goals threatened, please give us your overview and assessment of what it's taken place thus far. Is it accurate to call this a coup? And if so, since Trump has filled his cabinet with bozos and intellectual dwarfs, who really don't have the intellectual acumen to be part of the deep state, Rick Perry, I'm wondering whether or not he's capable of passing a driver's test. Is it true that he is attempting to create his own personal deep state, controlled or at least directed by Steve Bannon, in order to alienate others who would want him removed? And finally, besides himself and his family, who is Trump serving?
Well, I would say it's like this, is that, as you remember, we talked about one time in a couple shows ago. I believe that the critical period in our recent past history was this whole period between 1975, 76, 77, in that period where the regular Democratic Party had enough of the people on the liberal side of the agenda that they mounted this counterattack. Under Senator Frank Church in the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence Abuse, and on the House side under Otis Pike and the Pike Commission. And they began to dig into the Central Intelligence Agency, revealing the fact that not only had the Central Intelligence Agency been involved in direct criminal conspiracies with professional organized crime people in the mafia to carry out political assassinations and to import heroin from the Golden Triangle in Southeast Asia through Cuba into the United States to help finance their criminal covert operations in combination with fascists down in South America that had been snuck out of Europe at the end of World War II into Argentina and Brazil and Bolivia, etc. But that, in fact, this entire criminal conspiracy was mounting an attack against Frank Church and against Dick Clark of Iowa, who opposed the CIA operations in Africa, for example, and against George Bush and against these people who were trying to stand up and stop the accelerating encroachment on the part of this national security state. But at the same time, what had happened is that the George H.W. Bush and his people staged a counter coup at that point in 1980 in the famous October Surprise, where they actually reached out to a foreign adversary, in that case the people in the Middle East in Iran, in the Hezbollah, and they reached out through Bill Casey, the campaign chairman for the Reagan-Bush presidential campaign in 1980, and actually established a secret agreement with them to have those people hold the hostages, the 52 American hostages that had been kidnapped from the American embassy in Tehran. And what they did is they entered into a criminal conspiracy with these adversaries to unseat President Jimmy Carter, because President Jimmy Carter coming into power was sort of the point of the spear of this entire counter coup against the CIA that had been set up by these financial institutions, by these military industrial financial institutions of Brown Brothers Harriman, major banking interests, the John D. Rockefeller and the Chase Manhattan Bank and the J.P. Morgan Guarantee Trust and the others. These are the people who actually had generated the rise of the Third Reich in Europe to constitute a bulwark against Bolshevism in Europe. And the bottom line is, at the end of World War II, when that didn't work, because Hitler got out of the control of the major corporate capitalist interests and became a power unto himself, that what happened is, at the end of World War II, they reached out, these same financiers and bankers and industrialists that had tried to stop us from going into war against Germany, that they reached back out and reestablished this alliance with these fascists and helped sneak them out with the help of Pius XII and the Catholic Church down into Latin America and Argentina and Brazil and Bolivia, etc. And they continued this extreme right-wing fascist conspiracy around the world to try to superimpose that type of elite Caucasian racialist elite in the world and through the capitalist economic system. And that operation was under full swing. And I believe that George H.W. Bush, who was the grandson of George Herbert Walker, that's the George H.W., George Herbert Walker, his grandfather, who was the CEO of Brown Brothers Harriman, which was the nest of where these people sat and met together all during the 1920s and 30s, that this effort was that arose was having George H.W. Bush be president of the United States and have the CIA that was created at the end of World War II be headed up by the fellow named Theodore G. Shackley, who was a handmaiden to Major General Reinhard Galen, who was the head of the Third Reich's anti-Soviet and anti-Eastern Bloc intelligence, to have this group of people make a comeback, a major surge that they were intending to have take place in 1976 to 1980. That's when they were planning to do this. This was, you know, approximately 50 years. After the end of World War II in 1945, in 1975, just 30 years later, they were going to try to stage a major comeback. And they were going to be overthrowing governments all through South America, Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay, Nicaragua, El Salvador, and they were going to establish a major base for the right-wing fascists. And they were intending to rise into a position of power in the United States to establish this new Northern Industrial Alliance that they were talking about. And that I believe that got short-circuited, that what happened is that the liberal forces in the Democratic Party rose up and tried to oppose them. They were struck down by this counter coup in 1980. And when the Reagan-Bush administration came to power, we, a number of us in the progressive community, rose up and challenged them, caught them engaged in the Iran-Contra conspiracy to try to establish a complete alternative government, a secret government that was functioning outside of the control of Congress, outside of democratic institutions, to carry on this alliance with these fascist elements around the world. in that we held them in check. We pushed them back temporarily. But the special prosecutor, Lawrence Walsh, that came in, tried to warn us about this. He said that it turns out that neither the Republican nor the Democratic Party had the political independence or will anymore to stop this organization, and that we were going to pay the price for this. That he said that these people were going to come back with a vengeance. And in this time, rather than be operating under the rubric of anti-communism, they were going to be operating under the rubric of anti-terrorism. And that was what has happened here. What we've seen is they have consolidated their power, and that they have come back under this rubric of anti-terrorism. It's perfectly obvious that as soon as they began to realize that the Soviet Union was going to withdraw from the Cold War at the end of 1991, that immediately they invaded and occupied the Middle Eastern oil fields. That's what that was all about under George H.W. Bush, George Bush Sr. They invaded the Middle Eastern oil fields after instigating Saddam Hussein to go into Kuwait. You know, we've talked about this in a previous show. A handwritten note came directly from George H.W. Bush to Saddam Hussein, saying, look, I know you've been having controversy with Kuwait on your southern border. You believe that they're slant drilling under your borders and taking Iraqi oil. And if, in fact, you find it necessary to resort to the use of military force, I want you to know that I would not view that as contrary to the long-term best interests of the United States. And as soon as Saddam Hussein made that move into Kuwait, the U.S. under George H.W. Bush and his Secretary of Defense, Dick Cheney, went and met with Saudi Arabia, right where Trump is getting ready to go now. He's heading to Saudi Arabia, and that alliance over the oil that was there, George H.W. Bush being a major oil family, that Zapata Oil Corporation, that's who they are. And that whole group bonded together to seize control of the Middle Eastern oil fields. And that is what has generated the response on the part of Osama bin Laden, on the part of the Muslim Brotherhood, on the part of the various factions, Al-Qaeda and the Hezbollah and the other groups, and now ISIS, the latest, demon of the week or demon of the month. You know, they're all part of the Muslim Brotherhood who have risen up to try to throw the Western powers out of their position of having invaded and seized and occupied the Middle Eastern oil fields. This is all about oil, which is all about power and dominion. And that's what these people are into. They're an elite, male, Caucasian, capitalist group that believe they can assert a full-spectrum dominance over the world. And they have made their move. They made their move to try to get George Bush's other son, come in to be the new president. That was what the whole point was with Jeb Bush. They thought they were going to get Jeb Bush, now made president of the United States. But this other guy who was a simpleton and took a very simplistic view toward, I understand the agenda, he says. I'm going to just call it like it is. I'm going to call a spade a spade. I'm going to start pushing all this jingoist stuff about America first. He basically latched on to the agenda of the Project for a New American Century, which was to lift up and push forward the United States in a unilateral way to become a military economic power to establish dominion over the rest of the world. The problem is that the Republican Party, this is a little technical, but I believe the Republican Party had set up a nominating process whereby all they had to do is have a person get more votes than any of the rest of the candidates in a Republican primary. He didn't have to get a majority of the delegates to win the primary in that state. He just needed to get more than anybody else. And they thought Jeb Bush was going to be able to do that. And so they set up a unique mechanism by means of which they were going to accelerate the selection of their presidential candidate because they were certain that Hillary Clinton was going to be the runaway nominee for the Democratic Party. So they set up a mechanism, and it turns out that Donald Trump was able to take advantage of that because he was a bullying, blustering, domineering type, and he basically just crushed everybody around him with lies and appeals to bigotry and ethnocentrism and misogyny. You know, he basically otherized all of the minority groups in the country. And he rose to power, and he has seized power. And what they think is that they thought they could leave him in long enough so they could reduce the corporate income tax from 33% to 15%. They could get rid of their so-called death tax, the inheritance tax on all the rich. They wanted to just completely eliminate that. They wanted to be able to reduce the highest levels of income tax to have a flat tax for the wealthiest people. They wanted to be able to allow the people who had money all abroad down in the islands of in the Caribbean to bring all their money home with minimal taxes to be paid on it. They had an agenda that they wanted him to meet. And they said, well, look, he's at least smart enough to do that. But it turns out he's not. He doesn't have any kind of experience. He doesn't even know what an impeachable offense looks like. You know, he doesn't even know what obstruction of justice is. He'll go on a national television show and openly admit right in front of everybody that he fired Comey because he wanted to stop the investigation, trying to link him together with inappropriate contacts with the Soviets. And he thought that just reaching out to the Soviet Union, who they wanted to be oil partners with, was going to be perfectly okay. And you might as well start doing it, you know, right in your campaign, because, you know, he is so ignorant and so childlike. There's an interesting article today by David Brooks talking about Trump just being a kind of an egotistical child who's never really grown up. And he's completely fascinated with his own celebrity and doesn't really know what he's doing half the time. And these people have now, they're like deer in the headlights. They've got this basic political moron being the point of the spear of their insurgency, trying to assert power over the rest of the world. And he's an incompetens mentis. And they're trying to figure out now what to do about him. And the Democratic Party is going to be demanding the appointment of a special prosecutor. Lawrence Tribe, my professor at Harvard Law School of Constitutional Law, has come on television on the Lawrence O'Donnell show four nights ago and said this is clearly impeachable offenses. This is textbook obstruction of justice. Firing the head of the FBI to stop an investigation of the very crimes that they believe he may be impeached for, you know, and it's a complete replay of the Nixon administration, and so you're getting all of this stuff happening now, and there's a huge destabilization of the power structure right now. There's this peculiar three-way battle going on between the extreme right-wing elements that are inside the Republican Party, the overtly reactionary elements that are part of the Project for a New American Century, part of Dick Cheney and Paul Wolfowitz and David Addington and all those hardcore right-wing neo-fascists. Then you got your other more just simply conservative elements. They're big business people, et cetera, that are not part of the whole criminal conspiracy. They're just sitting around making, you know, money. And then you've got the Democratic Party, who are now the new moderates, the new more moderate Democratic Party since the end of the Cold War. You've got this three-way debate going on about who is going to rise into power. And you got Bernie Sanders, the kind of liberal and progressive elements that have been historically in the Democratic Party, that are the Franklin Roosevelt kind of social Democrats, that are all there waiting to come into power. And they've actually set up now a shadow cabinet with Lawrence Tribe, Larry Tribe, the Harvard Law School constitutional law professor, as the attorney general, and Robert Reich as the secretary of labor and commerce. They've got 18 different people in a shadow cabinet that are basically moving into place as a potential government in waiting. And the challenge that we're faced with, and this is an important thing I'd like to make very clear, the major challenge that we have right now is not the one of simply getting the progressive reformists in power and getting a Trump out of there as soon as possible. The real challenge is that we get him out of there really soon and we move a progressive government into place, a Bernie Sanders-type regime. The fact is that the hardcore 25% of the people who've been voting for Trump because they're reactionary, racist, and provincialist are going to be in the streets with guns. And they're going to come out and they're going to be furious. They're going to call this a socialist or a communist government. And we're going to be in the streets. And there's a danger of repeating exactly what happened in Germany in the 1930s. you know, these hardcore right-wing people instigating violence like they did in Berkeley. You saw them come into Berkeley and attack the anti-Trump demonstrators. You know, and the anti-Trump demonstrators are going to start fighting back. And that there's going to, I'm concerned that there's going to be fighting in the streets. That's what I'm concerned about. And yet, I'm the last person in the world that is an advocate of this middle marginalist, you know, mealy-mouthed, incrementalist type of government where you, for example, instead of having single-payer health system, you have this catastrophe of the Obamacare, which is basically a soporific to the insurance companies, you know, and it doesn't really provide adequate health service at all. So that we're really faced with a genuine crisis here, which, from the typical Chinese point of view, is a threat of terrible catastrophe, but at the same time, extraordinary opportunity.
Danny, I'd like to address some of the things you've pointed. I'm witnessing, particularly within the media, a concerted strategic effort to undermine the left. Yes. Increasingly, the left is being alienated, although at the grassroots level, we're observing a resurgence in the popular consciousness, albeit still fragmented across various singular issues and not yet unified in any kind of cohesive manner. There are still too many organizations such as MoveOn.org and Michael Moore's efforts tied into the middle-of-the-road Democratic Party contingent, or at best slightly left of center. Now, given the widening split between the left and the right, we're watching across Europe and in the United States and the disappearance of a strong moderate constituency in those countries. And I believe the American left is not even conscious of how it's being undermined by Washington, including and especially the Democratic Party. And we now know that within 24 hours of losing the election, Hillary Clinton and her top advisors decided on a strategy which has worked beautifully, and that is to say that it was all about WikiLeaks and Trump and the Russians and James Comey. And the media is so much in alignment with her that they're agreeing with this, and that's the only message. Now, I would take a slightly different perspective. I've spent a lot of time, Danny, in the last 7 years interviewing a lot of people for the film called Poverty Inc. And in that film, I had a chance to go back to West Virginia, where I grew up in Appalachia. And I'm seeing people who voted for Trump now who are not misogynist, they're not racist, they are simply people who everyone at different times promised something they did not deliver. Reagan promised, Carter promised, Clinton's promised, Bush promised, Obama promised, no one delivered. They wanted their votes, so they said, we're going to do this, this, and this, and they didn't do it. In fact, when I spoke with some people in a coal mining town, they were all into any form of new energy, including solar or including hydroponics, as long as they could work, as long as they could have a sustainable living. They really are not in any of the intricacies. They have no nuance when it comes to politics. If whoever says something that they hope will work, they're going to agree to. But they knew that the Democrats had lied to them. Obama's promises were never fulfilled. Therefore, they didn't trust Obama, and they didn't trust Clinton. Now, so those people represent, in my personal opinion, the majority of those. You're not going to see them in the streets fighting anyone. They're more often than not going to be taking the young ones. They're going to be taking opiates like oxytocin.
Cotton.
And the olders are drinking alcohol, but they have no life, and they've kind of withered away.
And that crystal meth stuff that's going on, and it's just pounding.
And that's mainly white, once working class people who do not see a way out of their depression because no one's helping them. The energy and the money has gone into re-urbanizing and gentrifying neighborhoods in New York, San Francisco, Baltimore. But if you to get to West Palm Beach, to get to Mar-a-Lago, his mansion, you have to go. And I've been in West Palm Beach because I do a PBS program down there, and many, many times. And you go through a ghetto. You go through 2 miles of really a rough neighborhood to get to the nice area. So we pay attention to the nice area. We concentrate resources, development in the nice area, and nothing to the poor areas. So you see groups of people who've been left out. You also see what I believe is the largest single block of people in America. That is educated individuals who are aware of the issues and say a curse on both their houses. They don't want any Clintons and Obamas. They don't want any of these so-called New Deal Democrats like Al Gore and Clinton because they see them as self-serving corporatists. They don't want anything to do with the Republicans. They see the tenacity towards war, the Robert Kagans and Gloria Nuland, his wife at the State Department, who was behind the Russian coup. They don't want these people, so they stayed out. Remember, more people who could have voted did not vote than voted either Democrat or Republican. You still have about 46% of the American people are independent. They didn't vote Democrat or Republican. So what you have, and these are not violent people, so what you have is you have a nation divided, a nation depressed, a nation angst-ridden. Now, who you may see, and who I would agree absolutely with you, is the people who listen to Rush Limbaugh, the people who are on the far end of the radical perspective, who really see people of different colors, immigrants, and people who are considered progressives or liberals as the enemy. And they are right behind these demagogues. And that's who, and there's probably in the neighborhood, I'm guessing, around all told, because you're looking at the same people that Rush Limbaugh has as an audience, watch Bill O'Reilly, listen to Sean Hannity. It's not as if everyone watching every one of these shows is a different audience. It's a contiguous audience. So I'm suggesting around 6 million Americans are really at the fringe of intolerance. One step will throw them in. Now then take those poor white who are uneducated more often than not, fully reactionary within Trump's base. That's the group that's going to raise hell. That's the group when Trump does not deliver, and he won't. He'll make promises but won't deliver. And if there's going to be jobs, there'll be a private-public offering where they'll build a bridge, but local people will not be hired to do it. It'll be an outside company that's never built a bridge, but is in that interlocked, corporatized development group out of Washington, D.C. They'll get a contract. They'll make a huge profit from it. The government will pay for it, but the local people will not be involved. So we're going to see one big project after another, one big spending spree after another, but the average person saying, well, hold on, wasn't it supposed to trickle down? And at some point, they're going to raise hell, not just with whoever undermines Trump. That'll be first. But if he stays in office for 2 years, they'll be going after him. And so I don't see him making it 2 years in office. I see that his temperament wouldn't allow him to. He'll probably quit, as if this is just a regular job that he can, like Sarah Palin, he can walk away from it. Your thoughts on that, please.
Eve, you know? Again,
your thoughts?
Well, here's what I think is going to happen. I think that the liberals in the Democratic Party who were self-conscious about the fact that the Gebhardt moderates in the Blue Dog Democrats were kind of coming into a position of power at the end of the Cold War, who were basically saying, look, there's no real reason why we have to continue offering these soporifics to the people through democratic social kind of programs because there's no more a real center of socialist options in the world. So we can actually move farther to the right. And given the fact that the Republicans have moved in behind Dick Cheney and the Project for a New American Century and that kind of utterly reactionary element with Wolfowitz and the rest of the people trying to establish full-spectrum dominance across the world, that the Democratic Party can fall in as the kind of loyal opposition and be the new moderates and conservatives. Okay, and that they'll try to establish an alliance with the simple conservatives in the Republican Party and try to govern from the right of center. And I think that the people that were actual liberals inside the Democratic Party who viewed that with some distaste, but didn't really have an ethos or a fully formulated worldview to be able to articulate a coherent alternative to that right now. What they did is they've been kind of pushed aside for a while, and now they were surprised by the response that the people had to Bernie Sanders. And when Bernie Sanders came forward as an alternative to Hillary Clinton in those new, more moderate Democrats in the Democratic Leadership Conference, that people were surprised by this. And I think what they're going to say is, look, given the fact that the millennialists, some 83% of the millennial generation who voted for Bernie Sanders. And so they see this as the potential future of that liberal wing of the Democratic Party. I do believe that they're going to come in behind this shadow government that they've put together, the shadow cabinet, these people to articulate a full-scale alternative plan. I think Bernie Sanders is going to be mobilizing the Progressive Caucus inside the House of Representatives. There's 72 different Congress people who come from districts where they have universities, and people read books, basically, and they're going to try to organize them into setting forth a concrete, constructive, alternative agenda for the Democratic Party. They're going to present this as the planks and a platform for the Democratic Party in the year 2020. They're going to make a heavy run at the House of Representatives and the Senate in 2018. Remember, the former chief of staff for John McCain, came out and said, I think that possibly the only way to get rid of Trump is to elect a Democratic House and a Democratic Senate that's going to be willing to impeach him, to get him out of there, because I don't think that the Republican Party has enough courage to actually impeach him and get rid of him.
Danny, real short answer on this. Yeah. As a constitutional lawyer and scholar, do you believe that there is any evidence for the impeachment of the president at this time?
Yes. Yes, I do.
Good. Okay.
I agree with Larry Tribe that he is engaged in a conscious act of obstruction of justice.
Okay. I have one final thought regarding the ideology that now dominates the Trump administration. In large part, this was a brainchild of Steve Bannon. First, capitalism, removed from the Judeo-Christian heritage, is a danger to humanity. And second, we must battle and war against two what are considered by Steve Bannon barbaric trends. One is state-sponsored capitalism, which includes Wall Street and Russia and China as its main adherents, and his barbarity, in his words, is Ayn Rand capitalism or libertarian capitalism, which he charges with the crime of turning people into commodities. Now, mind you, this is Steve Bannon. Some people would agree, some people would disagree with that, but he calls this Marxism. And you talk about immature, which begs the question, how much does he really know about Ayn Rand, who was one of the most fierce anti-Marxists and anti-communists of the 20th century? And in his third enemy of the future is what he calls the secularization of the West. And in this context, he includes the millennials that you just mentioned and popular culture. An earlier Bannon called for the creation of a strict national security and sovereignty agenda that operates under the strict rule of law. By his description, this almost appears totalitarian. And secondly, it's promoting economic nationalism to oppose globalism. And third, his push forward with the deconstruction of the administration state, which includes drastic clashes of social programs and radical deregulation. So we're already witnessing this ideology being implemented in the bills and executive orders. So I'm very concerned that many people have forgotten about Steve Bannon, his influence with the president, and what that might portend going forward in this new conflict with the deep state. A real short final answer from you, please.
See, Steve Bannon is a strident, egomaniacal fool, and he's ignorant with regard to basic fundamentals of history. And what he's done is he's patched and paced together this kind of ideological montage that is basically authoritarian fascism. And he's trying to demonize certain elements of capitalism, just like Hitler did in his rise to power. He is a dangerous person, and the fact that he was on the National Security Council for all of that time, sitting in those meetings, was an incredible threat to our democracy. Until he is gone out of there, and Trump is gone out of there, and their entire cabinet appointees are out of there, you know that we're faced with a major threat of authoritarianism in the United States, and the first thing we need to do is get Trump out of there so that he cannot appoint 103 new federal judges that they blocked the appointments of Obama and the Democrats. We've got to stop the influx of all of those people. We can't stand any more judges like the judge that they put on the Supreme Court. We've got to block those. We've got to get him out of there fast. We've got to block the appointments of those judges. We've got to get rid of Steve Bannon right away. And we've got to, I think, that the last three years of his administration have to be put into the hands of the kind of more moderate Republicans, or allow them to fall into their hands. I don't think they're going to impeach anybody. The Democrats have to come forward in an aggressive style to demand the appointment of a special prosecutor. You know, I would love to see Sally Yates be the special prosecutor, you know, but somebody who is going to go to it and lay out a coherent explanation for why they've got to get rid of these people. And then what we've got to do is we've got to figure out how to have a soft landing here, because I'm concerned that I'm a complete fan of a lot of the policies and stuff of Bernie Sanders, but we have to be careful not to generate this terrible backlash on the part of these, you know, 6 to 10 million people in the country that will take up arms against what they view as a democratic socialist agenda. So that's our major task as the intelligentsia in the country. We've got to figure out how to design an alternative government in waiting that can catch our country falling, you know, and that we only have to fall a short distance, and that we can then catch ourselves and regroup and restabilize ourselves and get rid of this type of, you know, a crony capitalism, and establish, and I think, to outlaw shareholder-owned private corporations as a business vehicle. We've got to have, you know, for public interest corporations, the public benefit corporations, they have to take into account all of the stakeholders in a community, not just their shareholders. And I think that's a new form of a constitutional democracy that has a social democratic economic system. And I think that's what we have to try to persuade Bernie Sanders and his people that they need to move into place as the new government in waiting.
I hope so, because there's a part of Bernie Sanders I do not trust. He should have been the first one suing the Democratic National Committee to overturn the outcome of appointing Hillary, because we know it was immoral, illegal, and unethical what they did. And I don't want to hear Hillary or Bill Clinton anywhere near the body politic. Danny, thank you for being on again. I appreciate it.
Terrific, Gary. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to folks.
Danny Sheehan, here to talk about Donald Trump's coup d'etat, the erosion of the Constitution and civil rights, criminal conspiracy, and the White House's conflict with the deep state. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.